This is Living Planet. Hey, this is Kathleen. A few weeks ago, we took you along with us for a night walk through one of Germany's brightest cities to learn about light pollution from a leading expert named Chris Kaiba. For this episode, we're bringing you part two. So if you haven't heard part one, you can scroll back through our feed to hear that now. It's called Bright Lights, Big LED Cities. To recap really quickly, our night sky has gotten 10% brighter over the past decade. One reason for this is the widespread adoption of LED lights. LEDs are more energy efficient, so in theory, that's good news for lowering our energy consumption. But LEDs emit a higher percentage of blue light waves, the same light that helps regulate our circadian rhythms. A brighter nighttime environment is a problem for mammals and insects because the majority of them are nocturnal. They survive and thrive in the dark. Take the lowly vole, a rodent similar to a mouse. It's starting to evolve into a creature of the daylight because bright nights make it easy prey. Or the black beetle, that's so distracted by LED garden lights that it forgets to forage and produce offspring. Migratory birds are thrown off by brighter skies too. A recent Canadian study found that birds exposed to artificial light for more than 10 nights over a 30-day period ended up migrating over a week earlier in the spring than they were supposed to, and so they ended up arriving at their breeding sites too early. So that's basically what we covered in part one. But we wanted to do a part two because there's something really interesting going on with the research on light pollution. You see, it's not just scientists who are trying to find solutions. This issue has spilled over into other disciplines, like art and even ethics. Take, for example, this Canadian researcher. Dr. Taylor Stone.
Yeah, so I have a very interdisciplinary background. Every degree I've had has been in a different subject, actually. So I started in architecture and then did environmental studies and eventually ended up in ethics of technology.
Taylor's a program manager at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. He's been working on an unusual light experiment with this man.
I'm Rupert Griffiths, and I'm based at Lancaster Institute for Contemporary Arts.
Rupert works in urban design, but his backstory zigzags across disciplines too. He describes himself as a
cultural geographer, design researcher, and also a designer and artist.
Taylor's interest in light started back about 15 years ago when he was working on his master's.
When you talk with people who are very interested in light pollution and darkness, it's often about these transformative experiences of being in the dark, of being in these truly dark places. But for me, what set me on this path was actually the opposite. Of the first time I had gone to New York City and gone into Times Square, and it was in this sort of cathedral of light. And you sort of have this moment similar to perhaps seeing the Milky Way for the first time, where you sort of step back and just say, wow, this is a space totally created by artificial light, totally created and controlled by our technologies. So we've sort of chosen to create these spaces and these tunnels of light that have cut ourselves off from these natural rhythms and from this experience of the night sky.
Light choreographs all life on Earth. It's driving everything. It's this kind of master clock, really, for the Earth.
A few years later, and halfway across the world, Rupert was thinking about this too. He was in Xi'an, China, for a photography exhibition on time and light.
It's got an interesting identity because it's an ancient capital. And on the other hand, it's a tech hub and a center of innovation. So it's a very brightly lit city. It's incredibly light at night.
Rupert's plan was to capture Xi'an's night sky awash in artificial light, and then to travel to one of the darkest places on Earth, Tibet's Nagari Prefecture, and make photos of complete darkness. But it ended up being too hard to get into Tibet, so he took a closer look at Xi'an.
So what I started to do was take photographs of the night sky, so just taking many thousands of photographs every night. So there'd be like maybe 10,000 photographs with a lensless camera. So you just get a colour field image of the sky. So a single colour, basically.
He starts chopping up those photos into single pixels of colour. And then he takes each slice of natural daylight and the night sky all lit up and arranges them into a circle.
So you've got a representation of 24 hours of changing light in that circle.
Rupert calls it the light clock. A few years later, Taylor and Rupert meet through a mutual colleague, and Taylor sees in Rupert's artwork a way to move the discussion on light pollution forward. Taylor says we've cut ourselves off too much from natural light. In urban areas, we have lights on. In nature, we have darkness. But don't we need the darkness to be connected to the natural world?
And we really have to break away from this because cities are where we live. It's where humans are increasingly living. This is where we spend our lives. So if we really want to start changing our relationship to the natural world and really think about sustainability, not just as an instrumental idea of efficiency, but also what it means to reconnect with nature, we have to start thinking about our cities and how we bring these experiences into our daily lives.
By the time Taylor and Rupert connect, Rupert's already been using his light clock to visualize data he'd been gathering in several places. There was one in Beijing, one in London, and one on a nature reserve in northern England called Leighton Moss. You can see all of them on his website, including the one Taylor had him set up in Germany, in the Botanical Gardens in Bonn, to be exact, as part of a project called Rewilding the Night. Okay, so I've pulled up this light clock, and yeah, can you describe a little bit about what we're looking at? Because it's quite a beautiful image, but I can imagine somebody looking at it and saying, I don't understand how this is a clock. I can't read it as a clock.
Yeah, indeed, it's not meant to be read as a traditional clock of telling time. What it is basically we've installed different sensors, light sensors, in the botanical gardens that are collecting data regularly and transmitting it. And what he's done is translate this into this thing he calls a light clock, which is meant to really show us the changing conditions of light in the space. So when you look at this, it is this spiral, right? And every circle is one day.
The image on the screen is of a tightly wound spiral against a black backdrop. The spiral starts wide and gradually narrows into a black hole in the middle of the screen. Each rotation is made up of tiny, almost wispy circles of light, like the fine, delicate links of a bracelet. There are blue circles that represent daylight, and as the day progresses, the circles gradually turn into a shadowy gold, the color of the nearby streetlights.
And as we look deeper into it, we're looking back in time. So you can actually start to see the changes of light and quality daily, but also over months, over lunar cycles, seasonally, annually, depending on how long the light clock runs and how far back it can go. And so this is how it's meant to be read. It's meant to be this more of an artistic interpretation of the conditions of lighting and in these different temporalities that we deal with. And again, to re-engage with these qualities we may or may not actually pay attention to in our daily lives, and to sort of take a step back and look at these different conditions.
What's so interesting about this data is that it's not for a scientific study in the classic sense. Their goal isn't to spit out numbers about light pollution. Instead, it's an invitation to really take it all in. For example, how the night sky in northern England is so dark that the phases of the moon come through in the light clock. In Bonn, the sky glow and nearby streetlights give the night a golden tinge. In Beijing, a light near the sensors appears to be giving off green light waves even. And these phases of light shift with the seasons too, of course.
There's been a lot of interest in this way of representing the data. And, you know, people have looked at it from all kinds of different angles, like, you know, from policy to people wanting to look at how light might be affecting biodiversity in the back garden. I mean, one of the things that I'm particularly sort of keen on with this work is the way that it, as a timepiece, situates you in this like local and planetary understanding of time. It's specific to where you are, but it's also completely based upon the rotation of the Earth and its movement around the sun.
Rupert says artificial light has allowed us to become nocturnal beings in a sense. Part of what he and Taylor are trying to do is to reframe the conversation around light pollution, to really illuminate the complexity of this issue.
Yeah, and I think another thing is that it doesn't like dictate a position to people. Like it doesn't say light pollution is bad or artificial light at night is good. It just presents what is, you know, in the environment. And I think this was an important part of the way that I was thinking about this when I was developing it, is it doesn't have a aim to change people's perspectives. It's more to situate people within the environment in a way people can't experience in many ways, because it's, you know, it shows the night, which many people aren't going to experience the whole night.
It's striking to see how much artificial light shows up on the light clock, even in a place like Bonn's Botanical Gardens, where the night is almost pitch black. Their sensors picked up the yellowy glow from nearby streetlights and sky glow over Bonn. Taylor and Rupert want this to be a conversation starter about something more, though. As they remarked in their paper about the light clock in late 2024, making urban lighting more environmentally friendly isn't just about energy efficiency. It's about starting a much more radical conversation about why we even use light the way we do. Is it for safety? Is it for beauty? Are we afraid of the dark? And how is light keeping us from connecting with the natural world at night? On this particular night, they've invited their team members to go on a walk. They started their research institute about 30 minutes away, getting away from a busy street, then cut through a neighborhood lined with early 20th century townhouses, well lit, of course, and then follow the lights of the boulevard lined by chestnut trees that leads to the botanical gardens. Before we set out, Taylor asked the group to pay attention to the quality of darkness they're experiencing on this walk. This is supposed to be a conversation for everyone to share in.
So my ears perked up earlier this evening when you were telling people, you know, this is a lot about stories. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? And yeah, why exactly stories?
Yeah. Well, there's a philosopher in a paper really like about urban philosophy. And in the paper is a lot about urban restoration. And one way you can think about that is indeed planting trees, greening cities, these sorts of things. But another way to think about it is urban restoration is about finding stories and finding new stories about our cities and our lives in cities that we find meaningful or good and that maybe have fallen away or fallen into decay, and trying to think about how we can bring these back. So part of this project and this event is to ask what sort of stories about darkness and about urban nights we want to tell and why.
The botanical gardens are situated behind a Baroque palace, the focal point of this particular neighborhood. Bright lights illuminate its yellow ochre facade. This is where I can finally catch up with Dr. Nick Dunn, who seems to have been chatting with one person or another for the whole walk. He's Taylor and Rupert's collaborator from Lancaster University.
Light and dark have been cast in opposition to each other for as long as people have been on the planet. And darkness often comes out worse in that kind of equation. We tend to think of it and associate it with negative things. What we're doing with this project and the impact we've already seen is getting people to think differently about how they might adopt different policies, about thinking even about nature after dark. You know, we tend to think about green spaces in the daytime, we think about nature in cities, but encouraging people to think about our near neighbours, our non-human neighbours, when we're in a place like this after dark becomes really important.
I mean, aside from the fact that you brought two of the main people in this project together, Rupert and Taylor, can you give me some other examples of how you've seen, or during conversations, seen how, you know, people have really started to think about this in a completely different way?
Sure. So even this evening, as I was walking, I was chatting to a gentleman and his young son, and he was describing the idea that his favourite animal was a nocturnal one, but he hadn't appreciated that about 4/5 of collective life on the planet is nocturnal. It moves around at night. And because we close our curtains, we close our blinds, we don't necessarily think about the living world, this isn't just a civic issue. It's not just about cities. darkness is dwindling all around the planet. And with satellites up in the sky, we're actually taking light pollution around the Earth. It's not even a terrestrial issue to do with lights being fixed, because they're out there in outer space as well. So helping people to understand why darkness can be valued, how we can have an inclusive, sustainable and sort of convivial atmosphere in places after dark, and understanding where darkness should be and where it shouldn't be, you know, to make sure that we have the kind of atmospheres and ambiences that encourage us to sort of live in the world rather than always chasing that next thing and a fast, quick fix.
So you're an architect, right?
I trained as an architect. I'm professor of urban design.
And what did you learn about light versus dark when you were studying, or what role does darkness play in your discipline?
So actually, surprisingly little. We did a lot about daytime studies, and this is the thing even now. Most contemporary architecture education doesn't speak about the night at all. We talk about light, form and shadow, but we don't talk about the night. And architects, generally speaking, are very poorly trained. When we think about how to light buildings up, we're often using lots of uplighters, throwing light all across the surfaces. So there's more that needs to be done there in terms of education and information. And I became fascinated when I was studying architecture. To help support myself, I became a freelance crime scene surveyor. And I was working at night, seeing a very different city at night.
Wait, but speaking of danger...
Yeah?
I mean, that would make me want to turn the light on immediately.
Okay, well, I can see that, and that's fair enough. But what became very apparent to me is the daytime city, of which I was a student, moving around, doing all the things I did, doing the long hours in architecture studio, was a very different thing at night. And so I've been fascinated for over 30 years now in what makes this change, how identities shift, what can be valued in the night. So it's all about these preconceptions and the sort of cultures and histories we have, the stories that we tell ourselves about what darkness is, who the night is for, and who we share it with, that become really interesting to me.
As we go around the bend, down the gravel path, along the moat, the streetlights still feel a bit intrusive, but the darkness of the gardens and a few stars are finally visible in the night sky. A Canadian researcher named Dr. Allison Powell has been talking this evening about the role civic engagement needs to play in rethinking urban lighting. She's a professor of media and communication at the London School of Economics.
Well, light can be used to include and exclude. And we're walking through actually what is a pretty well-lit part of Bonn, which has street lighting, which I think creates lots of pools of comfortable appearing light. But because there's so much social inequality, lighting can be used as a weapon to exclude people from public space because of things like gendered assumptions about safety.
Could you expound on that? Maybe, I don't know if you have a personal experience with that particular comment.
I mean, I don't personally experience a lot of darkness-related fear or anxiety, but I think that some of the most interesting research in this space comes from Ayona Datta's work. She studied gendered infrastructure in India. She examined how the design of different kinds of lighting schemes allowed women to only have access to certain kinds of public space at certain times when lights were on or during the daytime, and also created a kind of sense of exclusion from public spaces when lights were off or it was dark at nighttime.
So you said you're from Western Canada, from a place that is darker at night than here, and you live in London. How would you compare it to here in terms of, do you perceive this as really dark or somewhere in between? I imagine London is brighter.
It's pretty bright here. I came to Bonn to do another night walk a couple of years ago. We wrote about this and it had just snowed and it was very cloudy and it was like the brightest night walk I've ever been on. But what I noticed about Bonn is that it has a different color temperature of its lighting. So many of the lights in London are LED lights and they are more on the blue spectrum. They're actually quite bright. These ones seem to have a color temperature that's more similar to like old-fashioned gas lamps. They're more yellow. So it feels very calm, and it doesn't feel super bright, nor does it feel dark. Right now we're walking through some trees into the botanical garden, and I can see the colors of the jackets of the people in front of us. So to me, this doesn't appear very dark. But I have spent a lot of time in dark places, walking around when it's dark out.
Could you give me an example of one of those really dark places?
Well, I spent a lot of time camping as a young person. So I spent a lot of time like trying to figure out how to like walk around in forests at night or walking around in twilight. And I was thinking about this the other day. I went camping with my daughter when she was about 7 or 8. And she'd never seen a beaver before, so she really wanted to see a beaver. And I said, well, we have to go at night because beavers are nocturnal. They don't have the same time scale as us. We have other creatures with us in, you know, on the planet that are different than us. So let's go for a night forest walk to go see the beaver. So we put on infrared headlamps and we went for a walk in the forest in the dark to go and find the beaver. And we were really surprised that when we got into the middle of the forest where the beaver pond was, that we could actually see the beaver. Even though it was actually what we might think of as really very dark.
And do you think that already kind of started to shape your daughter's relationship to being in the dark and feeling safe or not feeling scared?
Well, certainly she became less scared of being out in the forest, or she knew that she could navigate out in, you know, out in the world by herself. The city is different. You know, things that are risky are not necessarily about dark and light. They might be, again, about like the relationships that we have with other people, and also about the assumptions about what is okay or not okay for people to do in space. Like a forest, if it doesn't have other people in it, is actually pretty safe.
Once we enter the gardens, the streetlights recede into the background beyond the bounds of this oasis. The night sky opens above us like a gigantic dome. A starry night, if a little bit cloudy. It's a new moon, unfortunately, so no moonlight tonight. The pungent smell of exotic plants and trees permeates the air. The group continues chatting, ducking from the occasional branch that seems to come out of nowhere along the garden path. They stop from time to time to hear short presentations from the different researchers. There's one story in particular that stands out. A woman named Dr. Gina Maffey says a few years back, she and her husband decided to do a wild year, an entire year of living outside.
Before that, I had studied in nature and conservation topics and sustainability. But spending that year outside made me realize how much of our interaction with the natural world is typically during sunlit hours, you know, dawn to dusk. And forcing myself to spend that time outside during the night shifted my relationship and my understanding of the natural world and how dynamic it is during the nighttime. But one of the things that was very clear during the year was this idea of transition and how readily we accept at home, in urban settings, that to turn off and to go to bed, we switch the light out and that's it, you know, light to dark straight away. And that actually when you're outside during all seasons, there's this period of transition that you start to feel yourself slowing down, and it's like, okay, we need to prepare ourselves for sleep. We're getting ready to go to bed now. And it's a very, it's very difficult to ignore that when you're really in it.
So what happened with time? Did you start to, I don't know, dread having to go back to normal life? Did you consider just living that way permanently?
Yes. there is this saying that culture is 3 days deep. And it became really noticeable that the crunch points were when you really blurred the lines between nature and culture. So when you walked from the woods into the office, and increasingly there were feelings of like, oh, I don't want to do this. I want to keep it separate. And I think as a societally, that's what we've done very comfortably. You know, you can keep natural areas or nature as something recreational and separate.
And how did that change your relationship to the night? To, I don't know, the night sky, or just the, yeah, just what it means to be outside at nighttime?
So what happened was the wild year was, you know, it was really a way for us to explore our interaction with the natural world. But what we found along the way was the difference it made to our social interactions as well, like sharing these spaces with friends and family and colleagues. And a lot of that was linked to the night, because that's where we've always shared these spaces. That was where we would come together and we would make a fire and we would share stories and we would drag our poor friends and families out on cold nights to campfires. There was something about that social interaction which was surprising, because that wasn't the goal of the year, but it demonstrated how valuable it is to have those kind of communal interactions within natural settings.
Did anybody in your social circle say, well, I want to try this too?
Yes. Yeah, we had a friend who went on and did her own year and lived outside.
So we're standing in this, yeah, in this darker space in the city. Do you feel more comfortable in this setting chatting than if we were, like, I don't know, inside somewhere having a drink? Though maybe we wouldn't be having a drink over an interview, but...
Oh, I don't know. I'm still quite uncomfortable in urban settings. So, you know, a lot of my interaction during the year with the night was in, you know, pretty much, you know, what would be categorized as natural areas. I think... What happens with the light in natural areas is there is something comforting to it as well. And I find in urban areas, because a lot of the lighting casts a lot of shadows and this kind of stark contrast between the light and the dark, and you then can't see what's in the shadows. You don't have that as much in natural areas. So I always still have a fear in the night, not of the night, but in the night. But that fear is greater in urban areas.
So you've been rewilded. You've essentially rewilded yourself.
It's still a work in progress.
We'll be right back.
On this season of Threshold, we'll meet people who are devoting their lives to listening to what other beings are saying.
These animals have incredible social lives. We need a better understanding of how important sound is in their society.
It was a sound that I was completely unfamiliar with, and I could be confident that no human had ever heard that sound before.
Find Threshold wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by me, Kathleen Schuster, and edited by Neil King. Our sound engineers were Jürgen Kuhn and Gad Georgi. If you want to check out the light clock, you can visit Rupert's website, luminousnights.org. This was the second of a two-part episode on light pollution. You can hear part one on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. What did you think of this episode? We'd love to hear your thoughts, so send us a message. Our email address is livingplanet@dw.com. Living Planet is produced by DW in Bonn, Germany.